John Burke is an inventor with a background in physics. As a co-founder and CEO of ProC Technologies, he and his colleagues have demonstrated in hundreds of third-party tests substantial gains in the growth, the yields, and the stress tolerance, for example, of many types of crops by exposing the seeds to certain forms of electromagnetic energy. Now, in 1993, using mainstream scientific instruments, John discovered the presence of similar energies at ancient sites and eventually confirmed that they also dramatically improved the performance of seeds exposed to energies there. And after more than a decade of research at more than 80 sites, he now details for the very first time the surprising connections between agriculture and ancient megaliths. Various aspects of his work have already been highlighted on ABC's 2020, the Discovery Channel, the History Channel, National Geographic Channel, Fox Network, and he's our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast. John, welcome. Thank you for sharing your Labor Day weekend with us.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me a little bit about some of these ancient structures that we're talking about tonight.
Well, there's a number of different types of them, and they range in terms of age. We're going to be talking all the way back to 4800 BC in France, right up until just a few hundred years ago. And one of the things I really am hoping to stress here tonight is the fact that those kind of ancient megalithic structures are places that Americans usually think we have to get on a plane and go to another country to see. But the fact is that duplicate versions of even those 4,800-year-old structures are right here in the United States, northeastern United States in that case. And some of the mounds that go back 5,000 years in Europe are built throughout the Midwestern United States. And in reality, two-thirds of the American people live within a few hours' drive of one of the kinds of structures we're going to be talking about here.
Not too far from where I'm broadcasting from, over in Cahokia. There's some incredible mounds.
It's a beautiful place. Yes, it is.
Now tell me, what's the significance when you talk about this duplication or this repetitiveness of some of these ancient structures that a lot of them echo here? What's the reasoning for that?
Well, we can't say, obviously, for sure, but, you know, we can use some degree of logic to address that. And these kind of structures were built from Ireland to India in the thousands over a 6,000-year period. Now, certainly, if they were any kind of cultural artifact, you have to stop and realize there was no culture dominating that geography for 6,000 years, which is one of the things that made me even more convinced that they are likely to have a functional aspect to them.
Let's break this down, John, into two segments for just a moment. The ancient structures and the ones that we find here in North America, and then again get into some of the thought pattern behind it. The ancient structures themselves, what were the reasons, in your opinion, that they were constructed? Was it an artistic thing? Was it some pharaoh or king who wanted something where the world at that time could remember him? What do you think the purpose was?
I think there were a variety of purposes, and you're certainly some of the time, as you said, it was a political monument to glorify some leader. But it looks more and more like particularly the largest and most demanding ones, the ones that required the biggest investment in time, labor, and resources, were put up in order to increase food production. Because if you take a look at the chronologies of those societies, that tends to be when they start erecting these enormous structures, is when there's a food crisis on hand and they need to do something to increase the yields. During an era of slash-and-burn agriculture before fertilizer or crop rotation had been discovered yet, and therefore the soil would get exhausted in a few years, and before long you'd have trouble feeding a growing population. That would be the time at which suddenly they start investing huge proportions of their manpower in creating these structures.
All right, give me an example of a structure, what you think happened years ago, and how it might have worked.
Well, I'll tell you one. For example, the oldest civilization in the Americas, the Olmec, who preceded the Maya. Archaeologists writing in the very prestigious journal Science have noted that Olmec villages that had a mound, you know, just an earthen mound heaped up into an artificial hill, always had a better physical standard of living than an otherwise identical village just a few miles down the same river, that they actually had more meat to eat, their skeletons were in better shape, they had fewer deficiency diseases, they had imported luxury goods, and they weren't exporting anything that anybody can see to pay for this. And the same was true north of there for the Hopewell people of the Ohio River Valley, for example, and in others as well. And what happens is when we have brought seed to some of these places, now I'm kind of giving you the middle of the story first here, but when we have brought agricultural seed to some of these places, and left them there for a period of anywhere from 20 minutes to a few hours, we've often, the performance of that seed when planted has often been so improved that we've seen double to triple the volume, double to triple the amount of yields on the otherwise identical, you know, examples of the same corn. And that was particularly true when we used the ancient seed stocks that we were able to gain from some ethnobotanists out of Harvard. In other words, the same type or variety of seed that the builders of these structures would have been growing themselves. They were primitive, and there's more room for improvement.
So you're saying that some of these ancients would build mounds, and for some reason, and we'll talk about that, their seed production increased its yields more so than those areas you looked at that didn't have mounds built.
Precisely.
Now, that's weird.
Yes, it is. We've seen it not only with the mounds, but we've done dozens of repetitions of that similar experiment with some of these stone chambers, which would be called dolmens in the old world, just an hour north of New York City and on up and through Connecticut and New England, getting those kind of results as well. It is weird unless you happen to know something special. I was just very lucky that I was already working for a company that was using similar energies in an artificial format in a laboratory under controlled conditions to produce similar improvements in seeds, and through a few years of trial and error work we were doing so. So I was already in a frame of mind to see these kind of energies and to think in terms of seed improvement. And then when I saw their history showed that they were being erected during times often of famine and you know, need to increase food production, that's when things began to click.
Look, how did you equate some of the ancients in some of their artifacts with the increase in seed production? I mean, what even though you were doing this, obviously, as you just mentioned, with this current company, how did you even devise the idea that some of these ancient structures might be used for this purpose?
Well, we started doing experiments. You know, once I started seeing that there were similar, the energies were similar. Now, certainly the ones being used by the ancients, what they are is they are an amplification of the natural electromagnetic fluctuations that take place everywhere on the earth every day just because of the changing geomagnetic field. But then they picked out places where certain special types of geology will further amplify that same energy by several hundred percent. And overwhelmingly, that's where the ancient architects chose to place the megalithic structures. And once I saw that it was the same energies, it began to occur to us to, you know, let's try bringing some seeds there and spread them out and see what happens. And we began to get these results to and calculated them to high degrees of statistical significance. I mean, more than enough to be published in a scientific journal, for example. And we got this over and over again with, in particular, corn and beans and sometimes wheat, which were the staples of those civilizations. But there's also a certain amount of evidence that seed was deliberately brought to some of the henges in Europe, for example. And in this country, you know, we have a letter from a Jesuit missionary in 1803 writing back to his superior saying that no farmer here would dream of planting his seed without first bringing it to the top of one of these mounds for certain blessings. And there were a few other examples like that where we did see that there were anthropological or historical indications that people were going out of their way to bring seed to the structures.
John, were these structures built on similar degrees, for example, throughout this planet?
You mean in terms of latitude?
Yeah.
Not that I could see, not that I can find. They have really followed the geology more than anything else, and that geology can be found in all sorts of places, but we haven't seen yet a linkage with latitude.
How about ley lines, as we've called them?
That's a good question, because I think what a lot of people call ley lines are involving the similar energies to what we're talking about, because we know that in some of the spots, particularly in England where we've worked, this electric ground charge, which is telluric current in the strictly natural or scientific sense of that word, is being generated by water moving through stone underground. And we've measured that repeatedly there. And there's two different physical processes that are known to create that. When water moves through carbonaceous rock, limestone, or chalk, it creates an electric charge two specific different ways. So in that sense, you know, you could look at something like that as a ley line, although we have yet to find anywhere it would run, let's say, for as long as the Michael line, for example, I believe it is, right, that runs for maybe more than 100 kilometers arrow straight. We haven't found anything that's gone quite that far that straight. So I think it depends on what you mean by a ley line.
Okay, how about people, John? What about sickly people during these times? Would they, for example, let's just use a mound, would they be put on a mound to see if they could heal themselves?
We don't know about that. One interesting thing is that desert winds, it's another just aspect of physics that desert winds tend to be overwhelmingly positively charged, whether it's the Santa Anas in L.A. or the Khamsin seasonal wind in Egypt. And it's also well known that lots of positive ions make up to 30% of the population sick, in particular the 30% that are under the most stress. And it's been discovered by 20th century scientists that if you can give those same people even a 15-minute good dose of negative ions, it actually counteracts those effects and will keep the person pretty well protected from a renewal of those effects for about a 24-hour period. And in Egypt, if you want to look at the earliest of the Great Pyramids there, they were built just upwind of the capital at Memphis, during the Khamsin or seasonal windy season. So that in other words, if there was a concentration of a negative electric charge at the top of those pyramids, and in our book we lay out a rather detailed argument as to why there would have been, then during the positively charged Khamsin blowing over the top of the negatively charged pyramid, you'd generate a brush discharge, which creates a lot of negative electrons, as well as nitrates, which act as fertilizer. But at any rate, to put it directly upwind of the capital suggests to me that maybe one of the purposes of that might have been doing something demonstrative that helped the people. But actually, in the long run, ended up helping agriculture as well, but although in a different way than, say, the Mayan pyramids that we've
What about weather manipulation, John, with these structures?
We haven't seen any way in which we could understand how they could manipulate the weather. Certainly, there were places like for the Mayans where there was, deforestation was producing drought it's a partial contributor to drought conditions very often, deforestation. And as more and more of the Mayan culture's land got deforested, the drought situation was getting worse, the yields were plummeting, the population was rising, and we actually have as the opening quote of the first chapter of our book a line from Jared Diamond, the guy who wrote Guns, Germs, and Steel.
Yes.
his second book, Collapse, you know, How Societies Have Failed, makes this statement that throughout the Mayan world, they were going through all kinds of things to try to improve production. But in the cities of Copan and Tikal, now Tikal being the one that we measured, that here he says, quote, these show little archaeological evidence of terracing, irrigation, or raised or drained field systems, and instead their inhabitants must have used archaeologically invisible means to increase food production. Now, we brought traditional Mayan seed to the top of electrically charged pyramids at Tikal, which is the oldest and first city of the Maya, and got the most spectacular differences that we ever got during the nights at which these electric charges on the pyramids were at their highest.
What an incredible story. The structures, the ancient structures, do they create the additional energies, or do they just attract the energies that are already on the planet?
I think the best way to say it would be that they attract and concentrate them, the energies. These energies are already being naturally concentrated by special types of geology. Then these ancient architects designed structures in such a way and built them out of such materials as to further concentrate that and strengthen it. So I think that was, if you will, their chief role. Because we do have records that these energies were already in discovery and in use by pre-agricultural peoples, where in the Black Hills, for example, we found what is still an active Vision Quest site placed directly on top of one of these magnetic anomalies. And it's still in use today, and it's using a complicated system of cloth markers, which are identical in every detail to ones used by Crazy Horse's spiritual mentor, who is a childhood friend and shaman. And we've found written records of Sioux on the Pine Ridge Reservation who'd been taken to the top of one of these buttes and simply sat on top of one of these magnetic anomalies for a single night, no drugs involved, no fasting, and report the most amazing visions in the few hours before dawn, when these changing energies we're talking about are at their strongest. They're at their strongest just before dawn.
How do they work, John? I mean, so you build a mound, or you build Stonehenge, or something like that. How does it work?
Well, the Earth's magnetic field is ultimately the driving engine of all this, because of the Earth's interaction with the solar wind. The Earth's magnetic field is stronger during the day. It weakens during the night. But and this is true on every spot on the planet, but as our spot on the planet begins to rotate back to the sun, the now weaker field lines around us come roaring back to full strength very quickly in the 2 to 3 hours before dawn. And in fact, it's the most dramatic time of day for geomagnetic change. And any changing magnetic field, by the simple physics principle called induction, will generate an electric current in anything present that conducts electricity. And that's true for land, for rock, and it's especially true, obviously, for the human brain, which conducts electricity particularly well. So it looks like there were shamans, if you will, who could sense these spots and then utilize them for vision quests in pre-agricultural societies. And then somewhere later on, when full-time agriculture came along, they were able to make the connection that these were better for crop growth as well. Mm-hmm. We have at least one indication of how that might have happened.
All right. Stay with us, John. We'll get all these examples and talk more. Very fascinating. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. And our special guest tonight, John Burke, his book, Seed of Knowledge, Stone of Plenty, Understanding the Lost Technology of the Ancient Megalith Builders. The order information, you can go to counciloakbooks.com or amazon.com. Fascinating story. Back with John in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our special guest tonight, John Burke. John, do we know how these ancients built these facilities with the knowledge that this would work? I mean, were they told from maybe higher-ups that this is how you do it? How did they learn this? And we have just stumbled into it.
Well, certainly, you know, with examples like the Egyptian pyramids, it still seems pretty obvious. No one knows how they managed to do that, and I don't have the answer to that one either. But in some other types of structures, there is a clear evolution over a period of some centuries, starting, if you will, in around 3000 BC, all over Central Europe, you started getting what are called causewayed enclosures being built on these special types of ground, if you will. And they evolved into the henge. A henge technically being really a C-shaped ditch. Now, your Stonehenge and a few others do have rocks and stones there, and that's part of what draws us to them. But there are, the majority of henges don't even have any stone. They're a C-shaped ditch. And the key is this evolution and refining the how you can, if you will, direct the physics that's there naturally into a more and more concentrated format, so they'll do a better and better job. And then the American Indians started taking the mound and the henge and combining them and putting mounds right at the gaps or the entrances and through the henge ditches so that you were getting a double concentration there. And same thing with pyramid construction in, let's say, Guatemala and in the Mayan world. We see some evolution there. So I think to finally try to answer your question briefly, in some cases, we just plain don't know how they did it. In other places, yeah, it looks like there was a visible evolution of some of these structures. And these rock chambers that I was talking about that are in the Northeast, some of them are extremely simple, and some of the ones in the Old World were pretty much a big boulder perched on top of three small rocks and then covered over by dirt. But others are quite elaborate indeed, and, you know, up to 20 meters long, and have the most common thing they have is this thing called corbel vaulting, where the walls slant inwards. And the result is to make a sort of igloo-looking shape out of rock. And I kept wondering about that shape. You know, why were they pushing so hard to achieve that shape? And I'm from the Northeast, and it began to remind me of the old-fashioned ice houses that we used to have here, which were round and had pointed roofs. And the purpose was to let the hot air, which was lighter, rise, and the colder air, which was heavier, sink to the bottom and then stay on top of the ice so that the ice would last longer, wouldn't melt as fast. So I started wondering if maybe there was something in these stone chambers that, you know, was there anything electrical that they could have been trying to achieve this same kind of gravity separation on? And when I checked into the scientific literature on that, it turned out that, well, yeah, there is. And then we were able to confirm it with our own instruments that carbon dioxide, of the two most commonly ionized or, if you will, electrified air molecules, the most common are carbon dioxide, which is pretty heavy and it tends to sink to the floor, and the other, but it's positively charged.
Right.
And the other is oxygen, which is negatively charged and lighter, so it tends to rise. And sure enough, that's what you tend to get inside these dolmens or chambers. And they then, in fact, set up a pulsing between the negative and the positive layer. And over the years, we even began to find that the best results were obtained when the pulses were of a minimum strength. So this also looks to me like an example of possibly of an evolution in that direction.
That is amazing, just everything you're covering. Now, tell me a little bit about the equipment, John, you used to do the testing.
We used three main instruments. Fluxgate magnetometer was one, which is simply a portable handheld magnetometer that, to be very precise, measures the Z-axis of the Earth's geomagnetic field, how strong it is in that one point at that moment. The next one, which is the easiest to use and most enjoyable, is an electrostatic voltmeter, and that will measure both the electric charge on the surface of an object, like a rock, And it'll also measure the degree of electrification in the air, and particularly on top of places like those Mayan pyramids that became very valuable, because the one that produced the biggest improvement in seed performance on a particular day, I was getting on that early morning and pre-dawn hours, I was getting charges greater than I've gotten in thunderstorms back in New York.
Jeez, that's incredible.
Yeah, it was making me look over my shoulder at the time, to be honest. It was incredible. And then finally, the other one we used, which also showed dramatic results at the same spot in Tikal, were ground electrodes of a type that are used by the U.S. Geological Survey to measure telluric ground current, natural current flowing through the ground. And they're highly specialized electrodes. You stick two of them in the ground, connect them by, say, 100 feet of wire, put a voltmeter in the middle, and you can actually read the amount of voltage that's running through the land. And in fact, that tends to be run in proportion, in a known proportion, to changes in the Earth's magnetic field. And, you know, we knew we were doing things right when at places like Silbury Hill in Europe, the changes we got were occurring, in fact, in those same proportions. So different ones were useful at different type places, but when you could get all three together, you know, or two of three showing a change at the same time, that's when it was very encouraging that this was not some fluke of an instrument that was occurring.
Did you notice at any of these locations if there were animals present, or were they gone? Did they accumulate there?
The only interesting thing we ever really noticed in that regard was inside these stone chambers, the ones we worked with in New York, the dolmens, if you will. Only once have I ever seen any sign of an animal having gone in there at all, and it looks like it was a predator that dragged in a bird to eat it in there. Otherwise, I've never so much as seen an ant inside one of them, despite having spent hundreds of hours inside these things. So I get the impression that the electric field drives them away, if you will. They find that I'm pleasant or something, because that's you know, we'd put seed down on occasions. We even left the seed down for a few days, and there was never any disturbance by any animal, not even a spider or an ant trying to nibble away on the corn when we got back. So that seemed pretty odd, but that's about the only difference we've noticed so far.
And when you talk about the seed performance, are you talking about the size of, let's say, the corn or the yield per bushel, or both?
Both, yeah. And most of the tests we did, just due to available resources, were through the seedling stage, and would show that they would they germinate faster. A much larger percentage of them would germinate, because it does say, if you read the early white settlers' accounts, they'll report how the Indians used to put up to 5 seeds in each hole just to get one to germinate. And in Europe, in the early days, how they had to save 1/3 of their harvest for seed for the following season. So obviously, if you can improve that ratio at all, it's a big boost in what's available for food. But then we also then took it through with how fast it grew, how much leaf area it produced, its resistance to stress such as cold temperatures. And in one particular season, we did one grand experiment using these stone chambers in New England, where we had we used 3 different chambers. We had in each chamber, we had 3 different samples of seed that we left in for differing amounts of time. And then we had samples 100 feet outside the chamber, further down the road in the car, back home in the lab, and it ended up coming out to a total of 9 samples of the seed exposed to the chambers, and more than that in terms of controls. And then they were grown out by a third party, the Harvard ethnobotanist who had gotten us these traditional Indian strains, and he grew them out to maturity in his organic commercial farm field. And when we harvested all of that, the average improvement of those nine different samples that were left in the chamber for only 20 to 70 minutes, the average improvement was double to triple the yield. And it was in proportion to how long they were left in. The ones that were triple had been left in 70 minutes. The ones that were double the yield, in other words, double the amount of corn by weight, they were the ones that were left in 20 minutes.
That's all?
Yeah, that was surprised me, too. I thought, gee, we'd have to be trying for hours.
Or weeks.
Yeah. You know? Because these are very subtle energies. We're talking about millivolts involved here. It's not high. It's no high voltage.
But did you find, though, John, that the longer the seeds stayed, the bigger the yield or the crop? Did that matter?
We did in that case. In that example, yeah, with the range being 20 minutes to, I think, 70, 75 minutes. Yeah, the longer they were in the chamber, the better they did. And then similarly, we once got some bean seed onto the Serpent Mound in Ohio just as a lightning storm was closing in. And the Serpent Mound sits in a very unusual geological structure called a crypto-explosion crater, and there's all sorts of unusual things about it. And as the lightning drew closer, the geomagnetic fields rose pretty dramatically, and finally it was about to start raining, so the members of our team that were there, which did not include myself, had to run out and grab the samples. We usually put them in gauze bags so they'd be open to the air. And run them in, and we've got in our book a chart showing the rather phenomenal increase in seedling growth that it resulted. And again, by far the biggest growth was out of the one that was out exposed to those energies the longest, the last one retrieved and put in the car.
You know, it's amazing. When I was a kid, they used to talk about pyramid power, and
right.
You know, if you put, for example, produce inside of a pyramid, it would generally not rot, or at least it would take a long time. And I always talk about the story of a kid in school who used to wear a pyramid hat, John, and he aced all his classes. So there's got to be something to this, huh? There's got to be some form of energy that somehow these structures, they're almost like they're magnetic and they pull it in, huh?
Well, the thing is, we do know what's going on at the molecular level and the cellular level, because as I told you, before I discovered that these energies were connected with megaliths, I was already working with a company that does this commercially and had years of trial and error effort, and then years of various different biochemical and electrochemical assays to find out what it was that was being changed when the seeds were exposed to these energies. And when we did those same assays on the seeds that were improved by the ancient monuments, we got the same results. So we actually do know what's going on, and it's a little bit complicated to explain, but essentially it's sort of like an inoculation for free radicals, you might say. Just the way we get a shot of some disease-bearing organism that's bad for us, but helps us in the long run by giving our immune system practice and fighting against it. Similarly here, the energies temporarily boost the amount of free radicals in your cells, which sounds like a bad idea. But what happens then is the natural antioxidant defenses in the cell produce more antioxidants. They gobble up those free radicals present. And then what you're left with in the end is a cell which has now lower levels of free radicals and higher levels of antioxidants than before you started. And the key thing with plants is that virtually all environmental stress, whether it's hot, cold, flood, drought, or even disease, most of the damage at the cell level is actually done by increased free radical levels. So once you have something that's helping protect against that, it helps protect that plant against virtually all kinds of environmental stresses.
Somewhere in any of your work, did the year 2012 come up? And you, of course, know where I'm headed with that one.
Sure, I do. And no, it didn't come up because we really didn't work with anything that was calendar-related. So, you know, I'm in rather ignorant on that subject.
Okay. You are convinced that this was primarily used for food production as opposed to anything else?
I can't say primarily because, you know, as a minimum, we know that it also had dramatic psychic effects when used with for VisionQuest, for example. And certainly, nobody would have dreamed a few years ago that it was used for food production. So I can imagine there's some other aspects that are still yet to be discovered, perhaps, for pyramids and chambers and mounds. But certainly one of the important factors, I think, is food production, if only because, as they say, the chronology seems so consistent that they're primarily erected at times when there's a food crisis on hand.
How do you explain the fact that these structures were all over the planet doing similar things, and that's creating this harness of energy?
Well, what they are doing, wherever they are, they're in places where there was farming going on for long enough, a number of centuries, for long enough to create a serious soil exhaustion. And that's when they start turning to this attempt, this extra attempt to increase food production. And they went up at different times. As like I said, those stone chambers from Ireland to India were put up over a 6,000-year period. Then the ones in the northeastern U.S., the rock chambers here, were put up much later, around, let's say, 700 A.D. or so, versus the first ones in France were in 4800 B.C. So it looked to us, it suggested to us that it was dependent on when there was an extreme need in a particular place. But I'm not ruling anything out here. I'm simply saying that when it comes to some of the global questions you're asking me, I really don't have any knowledge on those global issues, just on, if you will, these case-by-case issues that we have found and linked into. Yeah, there's a global trend that when food production needs to be increased fast, people start building these enormous structures. And, you know, let me give you one analogy, if you will, that I like to use, which is the biggest things that we build today, if you think of modern humans, certainly the structures that we put the most resources into has got to be hydroelectric dams.
Sure.
And, you know, we do it because we know we're going to get a very physical and worthwhile return in the form of electricity, which is the lifeblood of our industrial civilization. And by comparison, I wonder if one of the reasons they weren't able to recruit populations that were often quite small to dedicate a huge portion sometimes of their population and resources to build these staggering megalithic structures might have been that they too knew they were going to get something physical and worthwhile in return, which in their case was fertility, which is the lifeblood of any agricultural civilization.
You know, in this facility that I'm in right now, I'm looking at a fax machine, John. And 200 years ago, if you were to talk to people of that era and say, we're going to have a machine that will allow you to send me a document or piece of paper with something written on it, and I'll have the duplicate of that on the other side,
yes,
they wouldn't understand it. They wouldn't know what it was.
Yes. Yeah, so I often try to look at things through the eyes of an extraterrestrial archaeologist 3,000 years from now, you know, arriving on this planet and trying to figure this out. And, you know, what are these things that we call hydroelectric dams, and what are these things that we call pyramids, if you will, and what are they? And sometimes I find that a helpful point of view.
Well, when we come back, let's also talk about the lost knowledge, because what fascinates me is the fact that through different time periods of ancient history, these facilities and these structures were made to do what they do, but somewhere along the line, we never found out what happened until people like you did their investigation. So that's next, along with we'll talk about some of the places right now that you might be able to visit on Coast to Coast AM. John, do you think one of those geodesic domes would serve the same purpose as some of these structures that you've been talking about?
That's a hell of a question. I had not given that any thought whatsoever. You'd be talking about erecting it on the ground with these same kind of geological structures, which
yes,
are called conductivity discontinuities. Then the thing that would probably be most next important next would be the material of the dome. You know, if you built it out of wood, which does not conduct electricity, probably not. But if you built it out of maybe some form of metal, it's certainly quite possible, I would think, because numerous types of crops have been shown to respond very positively to very minute amounts of electrical stimulation in their growth, even in the 20th and 19th centuries. I know there were early experiments in England where they ran wires over the tops of the wheat and had very, very weak voltages, and they'd raise the wires as the wheat grew, and it would dramatically improve the performance. It just, for some reason, never got commercialized.
Well, we know the Egyptian pyramids made out of limestone. Does that conduct electricity?
Yeah, the interesting thing about those, the giant pyramids in Egypt, is that they're built out of those two types of limestone. And the coarse limestone in the core is really dolomite, which has a very heavy metal content to it. So it conducts electricity very well. It's 25%, and I believe it's manganese. And yet the tufa limestone that covers it, that is, granted, it was whiter and might have been chosen for decorative purposes, but mm-hmm. that's the stuff that they went to so much trouble to fit so close together that even today you can't get a razor blade between. That has much lower metal content and, by comparison, is a much poorer conductor of electricity. So you've almost got the situation of an insulated wire there. You've got an internal core that conducts well.
And it's sheathed,
yeah, in something that acts like an insulator. Now, I believe the Egyptian pyramids worked in a different way than everything else we've talked about tonight, because obviously, you know, with those pointed tops and smooth sides, you couldn't be carrying your seed up to the top of one of those pyramids. I think the Egyptian pyramids were aimed for a somewhat different purpose. But I think the purpose was largely achieved because of the types of conductivity they were able to use in those limestone. See, because what you would be doing is taking the entire electric charge of the base of the pyramid and concentrating it at the peak of the pyramid without allowing any of it to leak out.
Well, some of the chambers, like the King's Chamber, maybe it was a depot for seed. You know, there were no. It was not intended for the hereafter.
If there was a way to get in and out, that's certainly a possibility. One thing though is that you can get, if you get a strong enough concentration when you have that concentration of what would be negative charge from the ground, from the limestone aquifers which did underlie the pyramids. And you get a strong enough connection of positive charge from the air, which you did get 50 days a year during the seasonal Khamsine winds. And those then electrical potential field lines that are positive in the atmosphere, they've got to pinch down to that tiny space on the top of the pyramid. All the negative charge from the ground's got to pinch down. And there could be enough voltage difference between those positive and negative aspects to create brush discharge. And brush discharge is like what they sometimes would see on the rigging or the mass of sailing ships in the old days when there was a lot of electricity in the air. It's just air that's now electrified enough to actually glow. Well, one thing that does is it gives off nitrates. It takes the inert nitrogen that makes up such a large part of our atmosphere but is of no use whatever to plants, and it turns it into nitrate, which is the biggest single ingredient in fertilizer.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the lost knowledge. Here we have, as you mentioned, structures from 4,800 B.C. to, you know, into many, many years, into centuries. What happened to the knowledge? I mean, where did we leave out here?
Yeah, well, that's the $64,000 question, isn't it? In fact, if for anybody interested in that in more detail, I'll be speaking October 6th to 7th, along with Graham Hancock, Robert Boval, John Anthony West, Robert Schock, on exactly that subject at University of California, San Diego, at the CPAC conference, which stands for conference for precession and ancient knowledge. And if anybody wants to find it, it's online at CPAC, C-P-A-K, online.com. And that's exactly the theme of that entire weekend, is the lost knowledge. You know, why do we seem so much worse off today in many ways than we did back then?
What was the time period, John, of the 80-some structures here that we've been talking about, basically? What's the latest one that was built? We know the earliest one.
Would have probably been around 700 A.D.
700 A.D., okay.
Yeah.
All right, so not too close to where we are now. So you consider the Cahokia Mounds, those you believe are modern structures, I would guess, right?
I've just taken what I've read there, that they've got some things they've been able to carbon date at around 1,000 A.D. or so at Cahokia, I think.
All right, so for 4,800 B.C. to 700 A.D., there were structures all over the planet.
Yeah.
There was this similar knowledge of an ability to attract the Earth's electromagnetic waves and energy. And then all of a sudden, it was lost. It was gone.
Mm-hmm.
Something must have happened.
Yeah, something drastic. Because look at the Yucatan Peninsula today. The Mayans fed millions of people there, and it can barely support 100,000 people today. One of the chapters in our book is about the civilization in the Andes that preceded the Inca by centuries at Tikal on the south shore of Lake Titicaca. And they basically had a huge population again in this high Bolivian altiplano around 12, 13,000 feet, where today they can only support about 100,000 people with modern farming. These people were supporting millions. And again, getting rich at it, which was another part of the chronology. People would be starving, they'd build these structures, and then they'd not always starve, they'd get rich. But you've got situations like that. You've got a really heartbreaking example.
What happened?
In Tikal, Guatemala, they still take their seed to the top of pyramids in the pre-dawn hours, but they take them to the wrong pyramids.
Oh.
They take them to the most recently built ones around 700 AD that were put up purely as political monuments. And those were the first ones we were attracted to when we got there.
Are they in the wrong spot?
And they're in the wrong spot. The geology there is dead. We measured them several nights long, and they're just, you know, electrically dead. Several hundred yards past them is a mini plateau with a 1,300-year older pyramid on it. It was the first one built in this first city of the Maya, but it's a very humble-looking structure. And that's the one where we got all those powerful readings and got those huge improvements in the seed. So there was a tradition that survived amongst the Mayans that you bring your seed to the top of the pyramids to improve them, because we kept finding the seeds. You know, we'd get there, we'd find the corn and bean seeds. They'd obviously bring them up, lay them out on the top, and then bring most of them home, but always drop a few. And, they were doing everything right, but somewhere the chain of knowledge about, you know, the real magic, the earth energy, had gotten lost. And one other example that I think is ironic to the point of black humor funny, if you will, is that Pizarro's scouts said that when they first got to Peru, the Incas had on hand at any one time an average of a 5-year food supply. And that was stuff like corn grown in some of the most inhospitable places on the planet. I don't know if you remember, but maybe 10, 15 years back, the Northern Hemisphere had a late harvest in the major grain-producing countries, and the world's grain supplies were down to something like 18 days.
That's cutting it pretty darn close.
Yeah, so, you know, who were the better farmers? And what happened?
And they didn't have the equipment we have today.
No. Yeah, they working with much more, you know, humble technology. But if, you know, as I used to say when I studied the Ice Age a lot, and people would marvel at the various inventions and the art as well of these people struggling through glacial walls 35,000 years ago, they had the same brain we do. They just worked in different media. And for the people you and I are talking about tonight, they have the same brains we do. They just worked in stone primarily, if you will, as a media. So it makes sense that they might be able to do some things with stone that we don't know how to do. But obviously in the case of Tikal, for example, there was a, you know, somebody died who was, if you will, you know, if it was as thin a chain of knowledge as, say, a shaman and his apprentice, and when the Spaniards got there, 90% of the native people died in a few years from disease or other things. You know, all it would take is the wrong person at the right time to die, and that's the end of that knowledge. Because even
no, that's a good point.
Yeah, and in the United States, again, when the first white explorers got here, even DeSoto and his guys, and they asked the Indians, wow, who, you know, what are these huge mounds all about, and who built these? The answer was, we don't know. When we moved into this neighborhood, this area, these mounds were already here, and they were already abandoned, and we have really no idea what they're for. Now, then I did tell you one tribe, the Natchez down in Louisiana, they did continue using their mounds, and it was observing them that that Jesuit missionary wrote home and said, you know, everybody here brings their seed to the top of the mound before planting it. But and in Stonehenge, there's one example that may make some sense about why that was abandoned. Because that was one of the things that haunted me is this very question you're asking. You know, if my thesis was correct, why would people ever stop using these structures? But at least in the case of Stonehenge, it was used up until 1000 BC. And then people stopped coming to Stonehenge. Now, earlier, people had come from all over the country to Avebury Henge, which is the predecessor by several centuries, and the much larger henge. When Stonehenge was built 30 miles south of Avebury, people from the north would go to Avebury, people from the south would go to Stonehenge. And then everybody stopped going to both places around 1000 BC. At the same time, fertilizer and crop rotation were introduced into English agriculture for the first time. You know, even though they're two of the most important inventions in the history of mankind, we hear very little about it. And believe it or not, it was only about 1000 BC that either fertilizer or crop rotation became known. And they seem to have swept across Eurasia pretty quickly for obvious reasons. And I think at that point, you know, a farmer with exhausted soil, instead of trekking in a backpack with 100 pounds of seed down to a henge to get like double the amount of food, he could stay home and rotate his crops, including the Celtic bean that had been introduced, and add manure to his fields and get maybe four times the amount of food without having to go somewhere.
John, I'm going to ask you to speculate for a moment based on your instincts and your gut. What do you think happened in terms of the lost knowledge we've been talking about? This cataclysm that had to have occurred that shut down everything. I think it might have been a little, probably even more extensive than Spaniards annihilating, Aztecs and populations.
Yeah, I must say that I looked at it in a piecemeal basis, and, you know, it looks like it could have been different things in different spots, and I didn't pay too much to the pattern, the pattern, if you will, but then I read a book by somebody else who's going to be at the CPAC conference, Walter Cruttenden, who does a very good job of doing a chronology around the world of how knowledge declined, and it really did shake me to see for the first time that there really was a time pattern. As to what it is, there's a few possibilities, and he'll be presenting that, in fact, there at that conference. But that was the first time I got to realize, yeah, that there really, since a few thousand B.C., there really has been sort of one direction on this, with the exception of technology. We're good at some things, but we've gotten much worse at other things. You know, certainly, we can build computers. They couldn't do that back then, but I wouldn't say we're the kind of farmers they were, even though we are producing a lot of food. We still probably do not produce as many calories per acre as the American Indians.
What about a spiritual intervention? What do you think?
I just tend to stay away from speculation on things spiritual.
You do?
Yeah,
okay.
I'm sort of neutral.
Yeah, fair enough.
I'm neutral on that subject. I'm not an atheist or anything else. I just stay away from speculating on those issues.
Now, of course, many theories about the pyramids and the other facilities we've been talking about, structures. How do we know yours is a very palatable one, you know, compared to some of the others we've heard over the years?
Sure. Obviously, you know, anybody can have a theory about anything, but what I feel is that one difference with ours is that the facts are all still there. Everything we've talked about is still there, and you can go out and check it for yourself. You don't have to believe our theory of what might have happened or could have happened. We have two appendices to the book. One of them tells you many dozens of sites around the U.S. where you can still go today and visit one of these sites yourself. And the other appendix gives you a beginner, and we also give the reader an email address where they can contact us for more details on how to get their own instruments and their own seed to take to these sites and do what science is supposed to do, to try to duplicate the results so as to either confirm it or refute it. And that's what we've tried to do in shaping this whole investigation, is to put it on a solid scientific footing by being able to allow people to not have to take anything based on word. And in fact, there were 300 footnotes or references in the book, and every single one of them is either from a peer-reviewed scientific journal or from a book out of a university or academic press. And the only other facts or statements that are in there are ones that were taken by us by direct measurements with the same very mainstream instruments people can buy for themselves today and go right back to the same spot and check it for themselves. And in fact, I just a few days ago received a paper from one reader from last year who was at the University of Georgia, who did just that with some seeds placed in a chamber and confirmed some of the growth increases. And we're hoping to keep urging people to do that. And we've had more inquiries recently from people asking more details on where they can get their own instruments, what's the best way to use the instruments. And they've already got a list in one of the appendices of various places that they can get to that are not too far away from them. So that's where we like to think the difference is, if you will. You at the reader can go out and determine, are we right or are we wrong?
Why can't we get mainstream science to really do some good studies here?
That's a great question, because I believe they are supposed to be out there studying the unknown, right? I always thought that was the job description.
Yeah.
But it doesn't seem to work out that way sometimes. I think the more controversial something is, the less likely somebody is to put their academic reputation on the line on something risky, I would guess. And the reality is that science, by its nature, moves in small steps. I've written some scientific papers, and you have to pick one detail, and it takes a long time to do the kind of work that is expected for you to prove that one detail. Then you've got to have several other people do the same thing and publish theirs and confirm your work, and only then have you established that one detail and you get to move on. And, of course, that's the strength of science, the peer-reviewed system. It makes sure one guy who puts out some bad work doesn't somehow get accepted, but it's at the same time the Achilles heel of science, because it guarantees that the wheels grind very, very slowly.
Are there any other areas that have been untouched on this planet that could be useful spots for structures or places like this?
Oh, I'm sure, just because there are so many that have been scattered in so many places, I'm sure there are others. Another interesting example is Petroglyphs National Park or Monument, which is right across the Rio Grande from Albuquerque, New Mexico. It's got the country's biggest collection of petroglyphs, which anthropologists now believe shamans carved into the rock to illustrate their hallucinations during vision quest trances.
Stay with us. We'll talk more with you, John, when we come back next hour. Phone calls with John Burke. John Lapp, before we get into more of this, take a moment, if you would, to tell us a little bit of Proceed Technologies and what you all do.
What we do basically is apply a, if you will, a laboratory, you know, artificial version of the kind of energies we've been talking about here, which are very, very minute electric currents hitting seeds as they pass between two electrified plates. And all that does is allow electrons to be absorbed gradually into the seed over a period of a couple of weeks and trigger that same kind of, if you will, that same kind of effect I was talking to you about earlier about improving the plant's ability to deal with free radicals in the future. And we've had, you know, good luck improving yields in commodity crops, but even better ones with vegetable crops, where we've often increased yields up to 20-30%. And I'm not talking about just our own tests. I'm talking about hundreds of third-party tests, whether they be universities or agricultural organizations.
I got to believe if people were there, standing there, that they too would, I don't know, be healthier.
Well, you know, my hair is still browner than all my friends my age, and they like to get I like to get around and tell them that's the reason. If they worked with me, their hair might still be brown too.
And you're pretty healthy.
Yeah, I'm in good health, and I agree with you. It might be that there might be something to that, because I know there's a great body of knowledge on both sides of the old Iron Curtain from lots of scientists, repeated work on ion generators and how much good they are for your mental health and your physical health. And in a way, that's what we're dealing with here is ions in the air. So there, you know, there's a whole body of scientific literature which would explain why this might help a great deal.
In your book, Seed of Knowledge, tell me a little bit about these balls of light you were talking about, or orbs.
Yeah, we don't pretend to know the whole answer of what's going on there, but we did note that particularly in our work at Tikal, where we got those very high electric charges, we were actually kind of looking for them, because we've noticed over the years people showing us their own photos of ancient sites, megalithic sites, and they seem to disproportionately end up with these balls of light in the shot, but usually if it was a flash camera, but sometimes without flashes, but particularly if there were flashes. So we made a real point of taking flash shots at night at Tikal. And what's interesting, as we show in the book in an entire sequence of photos, is that the amount of them present was proportional to the degree of electrification of the year. When we were on top of what's called the King's Pyramid, that was the late political one I told you about that had no electrical charge to it, or virtually no electrical charge to it, we'd take these shots and pick up maybe one tiny little golf ball size globe of light in the picture. On the older mound that had such dramatic improvements on the seed, we had this picture literally choked by these balls of light. And on the different days that we did it, you know, the higher the reading in the air, the more of them there were. And then as the electrification in the air wears off as sunrise approaches and the degree of electrification of the air begins to drop back to normal, you'd see the frequency of these balls of light disappear. So we think they might be, if you will, some individual balls of electrified air or plasma that are able, for reasons that physics can explain, to very efficiently reflect back light in that kind of situation, and that therefore, if you will, they might be symptoms of energy which are going to be more intense at these kind of special spots. And I just wanted to step back, if I could, a moment and
sure.
Address the last question you asked me before the break about, you know, are there a lot more of these sites to be discovered? And another example that I realized of one that happened to me personally was, people also asked me, have you ever had a physical effect at these sites that has really changed something with you? And the one extreme example was in the Black Hills of South Dakota, when we were taking a lunch break, and I closed my eyes and lean my head back against the cliff face and close my eyes, and immediately the world began to spin. So I got alarmed. I sat up straight, opened my eyes. It stopped. I did it again, leaned back, and as soon as the back of my head made contact with the cliff face, it was like the world was spinning. So I got up, and my co-author, Kai Hallberger, and I looked, and what do you know about it? I was putting my head right against a vertical quartz vein that we then took out the meter and measured, and it was extremely electrified at the time. So there's no question that these things are out. These forces are out there. They're around us virtually all the time. And whether we realize it or not, we're all affected by them, because literally these same changes happen to some strength literally everywhere in the world. And sometimes people talk about this, what's called the 3 a.m. wow. I don't know if you've heard that expression of people who've been working on a problem and they suddenly wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and then the solution has just popped into their head. Well, 3 a.m. is when these kind of energy bursts that we're talking about are at a peak. And they often don't come smoothly as a wave. They often also come in these powerful little packets, if you will, that have the potential to, do some dramatic stuff to your brain.
This whole field is dramatic. Do you think this is throughout the universe?
Well, it's got to be throughout any planet that has a magnetic field, you know. And I think Mars may be the only one in our solar system that doesn't. Because any time you've got a magnetic field, it's all about the physics of the way the solar wind interacts with a planetary magnetic field. These daily surges have to happen if there's a solid surface on that planet.
All right. What are the possibilities with all these forms of electromagnetic and, you know, the pulses that we might be able to develop zero-point energy out of this, or the ability to power up our homes for free just by sucking it right out of the atmosphere?
Yeah, well, I know nothing about zero-point energy, so I can't speak to that point. But certainly, if you will, what we've got is we've got an electrical tide that washes through the land every day. And some people have talked about the most powerful natural source of generating electricity in the world would simply be harvesting the back and forth daily fluctuation of the tides. And that is a possibility right there. And frankly, whether that gets achieved or not, one of the things that I like to think about now is that whether we know it or not, each one of us is involved in a daily electromagnetic dance with our planet, is a poetic way of looking at it, I guess, because all these things are going on all around us and affecting us, and they're, you know, at work inside our bodies as well as outside, literally every day, particularly, as I say, in the morning. But you're right. If you could find a way to harness the telluric currents, that might be more than enough electricity for the world ever need. Yeah.
Has anybody ever gotten ill because they got too much of this burst of energy?
I know that different people have different sensitivities, especially to these magnetic hotspots, the magnetic anomalies. And I know, in fact, one of the friends who introduced me to them, she can't get too close. She gets physically sick. She feels nauseous, and it sometimes takes her days to recover. So, and it's been shown in various studies that everybody can feel these kind of changes to some extent. If they reach a certain strength, and the strengths we're talking about are actually comparable to what happens on most spots on the Earth. But there are certain individuals, maybe 2% of the population, who are especially sensitive, and they can sense, changes that are just a fraction of the normal daily change in the normal place.
John, we'll make the assumption you're correct. You've been accurate about all this, but do you know how it works?
Which part of it works?
All of it. This energy. Why does it make seeds stronger and more prolific, for example?
Oh, well, that is because of the kind of molecular and cellular level changes I told you about before, because we've had that tracked with assays.
But how does it create those cellular changes?
Oh, okay. Well, the energy itself comes from the physics principle called induction. And it's the exact same physics that gives us the electricity that we use in our homes. Really, the energy at a power plant is primarily used to simply turn a giant magnet past a whole mess of copper wiring. And induction is the principle that means that whenever a changing magnetic field occurs, it creates electric current. And that's literally how simple, when you get down to the heart of it, our own electrical plants are. We get all our electricity by something, you know, some kind of steam energy or hydroelectric power, turning a giant magnet past a bunch of wires that creates an electric current in those wires, which runs to our houses. What we've been talking about is the fact that a magnetic change occurs naturally every day on our planet because the solar wind weakens the local electrical field at night, and then it comes back roaring to full strength in the wee hours of the morning. And that powerfully changing magnetic field, by the principle of induction, creates an electric current in everything that it touches, which means literally everything on the planet that is capable of conducting electricity.
Give us a few examples, if you could, of where some of us can go to some of these sites, present sites.
Well, you know, in terms of population, oh, I'm in the Northeast, and these chambers run here by the hundreds right through New York and New England. Unfortunately, most of them are on private land, but there's an organization called NERA.org, N-E-A-R-A.org, which is the New England Antiquities Research Association, and they conduct tours periodically of these chambers that are on private land. And if you live anywhere near Ohio, Ohio is the capital in the United States of the American Indian mounds that have not already been leveled by farmers to enlarge their fields. There's the whole area of really central Ohio is just chock full of these Indian mounds that are still pretty much in their original condition. And they have the national park. There is a national park there, the 17 separate mounds and a henge ditch around it. And then finally, down in the southwest corner of the state, you've got the rather spectacular Serpent Mound. But certainly the biggest mounds by far in the U.S. are, as you said, near you, then right directly across the river from St. Louis at Cahokia, which was the biggest in terms of population. Cahokia
was huge. Yeah.
It was the biggest city in the United States until 1830.
Where did they go, John?
They don't know with Cahokia. They really don't, do they? No, no. That just remains a mystery.
Did they all leave?
No, because it was still a village of some thousands in the early days of when Kentucky and those sort of and those other places were being settled. I've read some of the history, so it stayed still a big village for the Indians, but never again was it anything like 30,000. Now, the interesting thing, if you remember about Cahokia, is it's got that huge wall, 2 mile long wall, mm-hmm. built around the mound. So obviously some other tribes wanted those mounds rather badly, and who knows, maybe one day they succeeded. But there was also a huge die-off in the population of the American Indians, even about a couple of years, a couple of hundred years before Columbus. And no one knows what that's all about, although, you know, when you think about it, it could have been as something as simple as a shipwreck sailor getting blown across the Atlantic with smallpox or some other disease. But for unknown reasons, there was a massive die-off of the Native American population in what's now the United States about a couple of hundred years before Columbus, and that's what emptied out a lot of these areas and why these mounds were empty when the first white explorers got there.
So if someone wanted to go on a little sightseeing trip in North America, what do you recommend?
I highly recommend those places. If you're a little closer on the West Coast, we've got, in particular, mountains listed that were used as vision quest sites. And my favorite is really the one, again, outside Albuquerque, where the Petroglyph National Park, where I have measured some of the most strongest and most bizarre electrical surges in the ground that I have encountered. I encountered some I really have no explanation for. And what was kind of interesting was when I told the when the ranger at the visitor center found out what I was doing, she said, "Huh, you know, it's kind of funny. Every now and then I get these people that come in here and they tell me how much they just love to go up and sit in the rocks and feel the energy. And I always thought they were a bunch of flakes, but now you're telling me maybe there's something to this after all." That's a very good site, because the type of geology I've been referring to namelessly throughout most of the program is called a conductivity discontinuity.
Right.
And right there in Albuquerque at that spot is the biggest one in the United States, and the second biggest one is the Black Hills. And the Black Hills is where, you know, there are 4,000 Indians are still, you know, using certain of those sites as vision quests. But, you know, white people are not allowed to go on into those sites at night for exactly that reason. We're limited to daylight hours. And also, Devil's Tower, Wyoming, from what I've heard from the rangers there, they're beginning.
Now, that was in the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind, wasn't it?
Yeah, and apparently it, too, was like Bear Butte, where Crazy Horse used to go for his visions. It used to be a central gathering place for multiple tribes that would put up these same kind of brightly colored cotton cloths that we found at the other Vision Quest places, until I think somewhere in the 1920s the Park Service arbitrarily banned them all to some little, you know, the furthest part of the corner of the park, very far away from the tower. But now, out of respect for the Native American religious connection, they're allowing them to come back and hold ceremonies closer to the monument. And from what I hear, even as close as the foot of the tower, some of these sites decorated by the flags are starting to pop up. The place that we measured these anomalies, and the shaman measured them too, and there was the site that Crazy Horse used, it's the geological twin of Devil's Tower. It just happens to be covered by dirt. So my guess is that Devil's Tower is probably a very powerful one indeed also. And then anyway, if you're further towards the southeast in Alabama, you'll see just across the Mississippi, a little bit into Alabama, where the Tuscarora tribe had huge mounds overlooking the river there. And some of those mounds are sprinkled through even the Carolinas. And they're all delineated state by state in our book, complete with directions and hours of operation, et cetera.
In terms of ancient sites, which one do you recommend for people?
My favorite is Cahokia because of the...
No, I mean way ancient, way ancient.
Oh, way
ancient. Like the pyramids or...
Well, actually, my favorite is still the English ones. Avebury Henge, I would say, is my personal favorite. There's something about it. The stones are still naturally shaped. They didn't shape them in any way. It's huge. It's 1,000 yards across the circle. It's got what used to be a 50-foot deep circular henge all the way around it. It's got 66 stones still standing, some of which weigh 40 tons. It's big enough that it's got an English village inside the circle.
What if these places were power generators, John? All of them.
Well, I think they obviously were power generators. Only what the power was likely most being prized for was this increase in food production, because they were an agricultural civilization without need for electricity to run through wires, but with a desperate need for anything that would increase their food production. Because what we have to keep coming back to with this situation is they had no fertilizer, nor did they have crop rotation. And that means within 3 to 5 years, you have to quit using that land.
Okay, stay with us, John. Final hour coming up with phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM. John, is it possible that these ancient sites were also used maybe to induce fertilization in men and women in order for population?
Well, I have no personal, idea on that, but you would probably be interested to hear that I believe it was the antiquarian, as they called them back then, Stukeley, one of the first writers to study Stonehenge, said that the local people said that when a woman wanted to get pregnant, she would go to the circle and rub her belly on one of the stones. So
it works.
Well, that's what they said.
All right, let's take some calls. You ready? Oh, by the way, you're giving away two tickets, aren't you?
That's right.
What we're going to do is the first caller I'm going to go to west of the Rockies, because your event is in California, and we might as well get someone who's the closest to give them a real opportunity to go. But tell us about what you're giving away here.
All right, but these are two tickets for a two-day conference, October 6th to October 7th, at the University of California, San Diego, which is really a first-class institution physically. But what it is this is the annual CPAC conference, C-P-A-K, which stands for the Conference on Precession and Ancient Knowledge. And that very theme we were discussing earlier about loss of ancient knowledge is, you might say, the central theme of this conference. And the speakers include people like Graham Hancock, Robert Bovall, John Anthony West, Walter Cruttenden, Robert Schock, myself, John Daring, and others. It's a pretty accomplished crowd in the field of ancient knowledge. And there's mixing at the lunch hours that are fascinating. There are books for sale, book signings, etc. So it's a full weekend, and each of those tickets would be worth $300 if you were trying to buy them at the door.
So you're giving away $600 in two tickets?
That's exactly right.
Whoa!
Well, it's $600 worth of tickets.
In
two tickets.
But they're just two tickets, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Let's go west of the Rockies and see if he wants the tickets, and we'll get his question. You are on Coast to Coast. Would you like those tickets?
Well, yes, I sure would, worker in the light.
They are yours. What we'll do after you're finished with your chat here with John, I'll put you on hold.
Great.
We'll get your address, and then Gina will get the address to you, John, and you can mail them to him, okay?
That works great.
Great. Go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, George. It's just been an awesome presentation by your Mr. Burke. Mr. Burke, thank you for your presentation. I, too, have felt the very unusual flow of energy when I lay in a sarcophagus in the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid.
No kidding.
My question to you, Mr. Burke, is, have you done any studies on genetically modified or engineered seeds?
We've worked with them in the company, and we didn't do it with the megalithic sites, but we have used the artificial version of the same energies on genetically modified seed, and they seem to affect them about the same way as the regular non-genetically modified stuff. We'd get increases out of them that were similar to the non-genetically modified seed.
I would think that perhaps this would hasten the doomsday crop that they're talking about happening from genetically modified seeds.
That's a very long, complicated question you just raised, which I think might take us a good half hour or so if we.
Well, I look forward to meeting you, Mr. Burke, over at the CPAC. I'm not very far from it, right here in San Diego, California.
Terrific. So you will show up.
We will be there.
All right, I'm going to put you on hold. We'll get your address, and we'll get it right to you, John, and you can take care of it.
Great.
All right, good. Go ahead, Gina. First-time caller line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello?
Yeah,
hello.
Go ahead, please.
Hi. I wanted to share with you something I'm curious about. In Livermore, California, the Lawrence Livermore Laboratory.
Sure.
In the hills right behind there, there's a small power plant, and a windy road runs through there. There's this one spot next to the power plant where if you park your car, the energy pulls you backwards. And I just wanted to know, I'm just curious about it. I just wanted to know if you have a comment about that.
It pulls your car backwards?
Anything, yes.
Yeah, it's weird, John. And there's some other spots throughout this country where that occurs as well.
But no, I'm sorry, that's totally new to me, unless it's one hell of a magnetic anomaly that, obviously magnets can move cars. That's how they move them in junkyards, is with giant magnets. But if it's got anything like that kind of power, you should be able to simply take out a compass and walk around, and it should deflect the compass needle if that's what it is.
Wildcard line, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Oh, wow. Good morning, George.
Hi.
Good morning, Mr. Burke. I live in Livermore, so I'm going to go check that out. I know exactly where she's talking about.
How ironic. Okay, great.
Anyway, my question is, have you looked into any of Tesla's experiments and how this may correlate with the magnetic forces? And secondly, Art Bell's little antenna experiment he has out there that he seems to collect power off of. If any of this could have anything to do with this early morning burst that you talk about, is it certain locations only that get it, or is it pretty much universal?
No, it's universal. It's happening in your backyard. It's happening in your bedroom every night because the magnetic field lines penetrate everything on the planet. So it everything gets it. And so it's just that certain things will conduct it better than others.
Have you heard of Art's antenna?
No, not his specifically. I've heard of some people that have similar, have done work that sounds like that on the East Coast, but I haven't heard of Art's.
And what about Tesla? Have you studied him at all or any of his experiments?
I've studied some of Tesla to get a better understanding of brush discharge because that's, as I said, what I finally decided it was probably going on at the Egyptian pyramids because otherwise the Egyptian pyramids broke the rather neat pattern that seemed to be suggesting itself everywhere else, but they're structured differently. And so that I guess that was the extent of my delving into Tesla was to get a better understanding of that.
And lastly, for energy purposes, is there a way you think we could tap into this? Being it's regular and constant every morning, unlike solar or wind, where you're dependent upon it being there, is there a possibility of anybody looking into this right now for an energy source?
You know, I'm embarrassed that I've never actually thought about that and therefore checked it out before because it's an obvious suggestion. Certainly the energy is there on a massive scale. I don't know if maybe it's, you know, cost too many dollars per kilowatt hours or whatever to collect it, and therefore that's why nobody has done it. But you've just ensured that I'm going to try to go out and find out some more about that because, you know, it's one of the more massive energy changes that takes place on the planet every day. So if there was an economical way to harness that energy, it could be huge, yeah.
Christopher Dunn writes that the Giza pyramid is a Giza power plant. So he believes it too.
Yeah, well, I've heard that phrase from a number of people. Yeah, and I'm not sure if they mean it in the same way I do, but clearly there's some sort of consensus by a lot of people that something is going on in that regard. Yeah.
What in the seed case, John? What's the percent of yield over something that might not have been in that area, that region?
It's a wide range. If it's a crop like modern hybrid corn, that's already been bred to be about as good as it can be. And if it's growing in good conditions, maybe we'd only improve it 3 to 5 or 6%, although that's a big deal in commercial corn these days, if you will. With vegetables, which have not had as many billions of dollars poured into the breeding of them, we often get improvements ranging from 15 to 30%. And again, that's under good growing conditions. If the conditions are stressful for any reason whatsoever, all those numbers go up dramatically, and it's, you know, during the stressful seasons that you can visually see some very dramatic differences between the plants that have been exposed to this and the plants that were not.
East of the Rockies, your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
How are you doing, George?
Good, thank you.
Well, I was just listening to the XM radio about 4 or 5 hours ago on the CNN channel and heard your replay on the Larry King Live show.
Yeah, I heard he replayed that again today. I'm starting to get some emails on that.
Sure did. I was kind of hoping to hear you talk a little bit more, but it sure did get me excited about the George Norrie show coming up at midnight. You know,
I guess I'm glad you found us.
Well, about 2-3 callers ago, you had the woman mention about the car being pulled backwards towards the plant. Now, you mentioned that there are several other places in the U.S. I'm sure you've heard of the one in San Antonio.
Yes. Absolutely.
Well, there is a Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum in Branson, Missouri that I went to, and they had a cool little thing set up. They kind of explained what was happening there, like the downhill. There was like a downhill slope in a room with an uphill slant next to a wall, and you place the ball at the beginning of the uphill ramp, and it'll go up the hill. Obviously, it's an optical illusion, but the weirdest thing is seeing go up the hill, and that was explained at the Haunted Railroad Tracks in San Antonio. I wonder if that's what's going on in California. I've never been there, but that's just
very,
to think about
very,
it.
Very possible. I mean, it is weird, and they also have in Belleville, Illinois, the same thing with little handprints that they find on the bumper of a car apparently a kid was hit by a railroad train.
Right. I think that's the same story in San Antonio as well. But
yeah.
That's away
from the... I wonder if it's a myth, if we have the same stories popping up.
No, actually, there is, that did actually happen. The train did hit a school bus full of kids, but I think that just birthed the story behind these kids are actually pushing you up this hill. But I believe the accident actually did occur. But I wanted to get to my question with John real quick, if I may.
Sure.
Now, help me out here. I'm visualizing just a large hill, seemingly in the middle of nowhere in some places. Other places it might be near a populated area. But what I'm thinking is the ancients just walking through this empty field, would they just stop and say, here, X marks the spot right here. There's a lot of electrical energy. We need to build a mound right here. And if not, how did they determine that these spots individually? Because I couldn't build a mound right here where I am in Conroe and it have that kind of electrical energy, right?
Well, anytime there's two aspects to your question. Anytime you build a mound, you're concentrating the electric field, both the one from the ground and the one from the sky. So you are increasing, you know, the conductivity of these airborne versus groundborne charges. But it's not going to be that strong unless you've got something like one of these conductivity discontinuities present that you're putting it on. And my best guess is that, well, with the ancients, we've seen, as I say, even today in Bear Butte in the Black Hills, you can see that there's a shaman there today who can just walk through and spot any magnetic anomaly that's strong enough for our instruments to pick up. He's able to sense somehow. So it wouldn't be anybody just walking through the field, but it would probably be the shaman or somebody who is simply one of the sensitives who would be able to pick this up. And my guess would be one of the other ways it might be visible could be from, if you will, balls of light rising up out of the ground, because these same kind of energies would generate that kind of effect sometimes. And in fact, as we mentioned in our book, some of the earliest miners in the 1500s in Germany used to find veins of ore by watching for balls of light emerging from the ground.
Well, let me ask you, like, thinking laterally, does it seem that this energy is coming from the mound after the mound was built, or are you saying that the energy was there, therefore the mound was built?
The energy is there before the mound is built, then the mound further amplifies or magnifies the energy, and then you might have started, maybe they spotted the ground because they saw balls of light, and then after they build the mound, they get more balls of light, if it will.
But the energy has to be found first, and therefore a mound is built.
Yeah, for it to be worthwhile for anything much, yeah, the geology has already got to be there in place first, yes.
And we have no way of knowing how they were able to, besides seeing this light you're talking about, no way of knowing how they knew that at this spot there's a great deal of energy.
Well, yeah, one great way that would have linked it with electricity, too, is the fact that we have a quote in the book from a guy who for 25 years has been drilling municipal or picking out spots for municipal wells in Central Europe. He's a hydrologist, and the very best place to drill wells is on these same kind of conductivity discontinuities that we're talking about. And he said that in 30 years of doing this, he's noticed that the mushrooms are always far more prolific over this type of geology. And now if you think about it, the shamans were the ultimate mushroom hunters of Europe, because they were hunting the hallucinogenic Amanita muscaria mushroom that they used for their vision quests. So right alone there, it would make sense that they could not only see a good spot, but make that leap to better growth. And there are certain other crops that have been shown just in the last 10 years. I've had some readers sending me information where scientists who have established various other crops that grow explosively better with just minor amounts of electric current added to the ground.
What about people who are dowsers? Do you think they'd be able to find these spots?
Yeah, I would think some of them might, because, you know, one of the pieces of work we cover in the book is a study done out of the University of Munich, which showed that the thing was, not everybody who said that they were a dowser could do it, but when they analyzed or tested a lot of people and then analyzed their individual performances, about 2% of the people who applied to their ad and said, I'm a dowser, could reliably spot metal objects while blindfolded time after time after time, way beyond statistical significance. And their
I'm not sure if it was theory or if they were able to demonstrate that some of the reaction came from, if you will, an actual muscle twitch just before the stick moved that was a response of the muscle to the changing magnetic field. So that, if you will, it's really the body acting as the...
As a conduit.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and there's another very interesting experiment done in our book by somebody who heard about that experiment, got one of those guys who's good at that, and drove him across a gravity anomaly on which is built one of the biggest series of mounds in the United States. And he hooked him up to various instruments, laid him in the back seat of his station wagon, blindfolded him, etc. And both there and in other places where there were caverns, this guy's muscles, you know, tightened and loosened in that appropriate manner as the car crossed these spots, even though there was no way he could have known, you know, what was going on.
Okay, let's go to our wild card line. Your turn. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there. Punch it up for me, Karis. Wild card one.
Hello there.
Yeah.
This is Harry calling from Pleasanton, Texas. This sounds like my life experiences tonight. I lived in San Antonio for quite some time. I know all about that railroad track. And, George, I told you a story about what happened to us when we went one time too many and encountered some...
I remember
what looked like some 1800s cowboys that pulled a gun on us.
They were everywhere, yeah.
Oh, it was incredible. Anyway, the reason I called, I used to live in Georgia for 10 years, and I visited a lot of Indian mounds, the Mississippian culture.
Yeah.
They started back in the 800 ADs, but Etowah, Chukalisa, Shiloh, Okmulgee, and so forth. Mm-hmm. And they say at all these parks where they are that they don't know what started. Why did they start building these mounds? But they do know what they were utilized for. They were utilized as burial grounds. The high priest would sit on the top of the mound. He'd have a temple, and then when he died, they would destroy the temple and bury the temple in him and then build on top of it. And I sat on top of one of these mounds and looked around. Now, these are villages, very intense villages with moats and fortresses and a real culture there. Now, my impression was this, that true, the soils would be depleted, and they didn't have fertilizer. So what do you do? And all these were built close to rivers.
Right.
You would scrape the ground. The soil is very deep. Mm-hmm. You would scrape the ground and pile it up to get to the next level of soil, maybe 6 inches, 8 inches, whatever it may be.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my impression. Now, there's nothing factual behind that. It's just my impression that came to me while sitting on the mound that, you know, they would be scraping the ground to get to more fertile soil, mound it up. And the fact that they buried people in these mounds tells me that they didn't do it very quickly. In other words, they weren't trying to get to an end result. They were just building the mound and going higher and higher as people died, and as the high priest would die, then, you know, we'd go up again.
Well, one of the things we discuss is that one of the problems with the burial mound term is that bodies have only been found in a certain percentage of the mounds, and you know, for people looking for a quick term, suddenly they all became burial mounds.
Yeah. Right. They're not all graveyards, are they?
Exactly. And you might be interested to know what we discuss in great depth, in fact, is that even throughout the New World and Old World, the death, corpses, human sacrifice, all of those things were associated with symbolically. With.
All right. Hold on there, John. We'll be right back. John, where can people get the book, Seed of Knowledge?
First of all, you can order it from virtually any bookstore in the U.S. You can order it direct from the publisher off their website at Council Oak Books. That's CounciloakBooks. In other words, the plural's on the books, not on the oak. CouncilOakBooks.com is the publisher. And then finally, of course, Amazon.com, which also allows you to read a sample chapter and look at the index and that sort of thing.
Very good. Let's go to our first-time caller line. Thanks for holding. You're on Coast to Coast.
George?
Yeah, hi.
Yeah, hi. A wonderful show tonight. Fabulous show. It's very meaningful to me. John, I got a couple questions for you.
Okay.
First of all, I'll just tell you, I've been to many Indian Vision Quest sites. I'm a white boy.
okay.
probably like yourself, but the Native Americans have been very kind to me and pointed out where they are. The one thing I have never done, except for one time, is I've never been there at night.
Uh-huh.
So I've never caught the burst. I didn't even know there was a burst. The one time that I spent the night at a Vision Quest site, the Native American man said, "Whatever you," I was a kid, he said, "whatever you do, don't go alone." I went alone. I got so scared that I packed everything up and I ran out of there fearing for my life. It was so heavy. This place called Dr. Rock up near Crescent City.
At about what time did you get that scared?
You know, I don't remember. It was so long ago, but it was probably after midnight.
Okay. And obviously, the thing is, it's going to be one strength in one place. It's going to be a lot stronger in another place. And I would think if you can get away with it, and I don't know if you can, actually, that a very powerful site would be Petroglyphs National Monument across from Albuquerque.
I love that place, John. Oh, my God. That place, during the day, that place rocked my world being there.
I tracked something bizarre going through the ground that still I have not been able to fit into the paradigm.
What do you mean by bizarre?
Have you ever been to one of these places in the middle of the night and caused the burst? And could you explain what that burst is with the solar wind? What is the solar wind?
The solar wind is literally an electrified wind that blows off the sun in all directions. And the only reason we can have life on Earth is that we have a magnetic field that acts as a shield to protect us from all those ionized particles, which would otherwise make life impossible here. But what it does is the way it stops the solar wind or shields us from the solar wind is by interacting with it. So the result is on the sunward side of the Earth, it's think of a shield where the enemy hits you a heavy blow and your shield gets knocked backward and rings, but it holds. You know, it's something similar to that. The result is the field lines grow shorter, and when that happens, they grow stronger. But on the night side, the opposite happens. The interaction of the solar wind with the geomagnetic field lines stretches them out like rubber bands into a very elongated teardrop shape. And as they get stretched out, they weaken. So as our spot on the Earth rotates over onto the dark side, literally you'll watch the lines weaken. But for some reason, that happens more gradually than the reverse, which is when we start to rotate back towards the light side, towards the sunward side. At that point, these rubber band, it's like you let go of the rubber band that you pulled, and it comes snapping back, and with a force greater in some places than others. And also, in some cases, it's not just like an even tide. It's also got these individual packets of extra energy that just come through like a cannonball, if you will. And a lot of those have been studied primarily by Japanese physicists. The weaker ones are called whistlers because you can actually hear them on a radio, and some of them are quite powerful indeed, but last on an average of, say, 100 seconds. But nevertheless, this whole time you've got this tide coming through. And if I could just say one more thing on that, one of the things I was excited about was when a neuroscientist named Michael Persinger in Canada, who has worked on duplicating these effects in the human brain for decades now, when he and I got to compare notes after the publication of this book, we were both thrilled to find that the same degree of changes that I was finding on these spots were the same degree of changes his team has found over the years is the necessary minimum needed to create a vision.
Fascinating. Wildcard Line, you're up with us. Hello there.
Good evening, George.
Good morning. Hi.
Yeah, good morning, John. Great to hear you. It's a great show.
Thank you.
You mentioned earlier a wire grid that someone had used. I think it was a British a long time ago.
Around the turn of the century, yeah.
Can you give me any particulars on that? That seems like pretty simple technology to...
It was, but I think it became labor-intensive. Best I can remember, it was sort of like a net made out of electrified barbed wire, if you will. But the problem was, to work right, it had to be kept a certain distance above the plants. So as the plants grew, you had to keep raising the height of the barbed wire fence. And so it made it very labor-intensive, and then I think the death knell for it was the fact that it never got approved by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And there was only a slight financing for it in Britain, and they still had not perfected it, so it just kind of vanished after that, if you will.
Okay. You also mentioned some electronic stuff that Proceed Technologies had come up with, passing seeds through a current. Is that something that we can duplicate at home?
Well, let's put it this way. The company can for you. It's not too easy to do at home. But, you know, in our case, what it is simply putting the seed on a conveyor belt, and the conveyor belt passes it between two oppositely charged electric plates, a negatively charged one and a positively charged one. And there's a very, very weak, if you will, electron ion avalanche happening between those plates that adds electrons to the seeds. And then you've got to wait a few weeks for this whole process that I described earlier to George to take place, because it really does act like an inoculation. The first thing it does is bad. It raises free radical levels, but over a period of a few weeks, the cell fights back and ends up now better able to withstand free radicals than before that. So then the next time a stress comes along doing its damage by causing free radicals, not only the seed, but even the plant that grows from the seed will handle that much better. But, you know, the equipment's not cheap. The voltages are high. It's nothing I would recommend. You know, it's something you should put up the signal, don't attempt this at home. Okay. You could check the company website, which is Proceed Technologies, okay, Inc. Proceed Technologies, Inc. And, or just Google Proceed Technologies, either one. And, you'll get a much better idea from that.
Some of these companies that create seed, like Monsanto, do they use techniques like this?
Well, they considered ours. We had a number of meetings with them, but in the end, they decided not to go with it.
They didn't believe the technology? What was the reason?
I don't think it was that so much. It was a question of they'd already invested. I can only guess, but I think the reason was they knew they had already invested billions in the genetically modified part, and the thought that they'd now have to invest some more money to add another piece, another package to it would be bad enough, especially since their prices have been going up each year on the product, and there's a lot of they're getting customer resistance on prices on some items. So, and because they were going to have to satisfy themselves, they were going to have to start from ground zero and, you know, clarify everything all over again, find different markers that they could use to say, yeah, okay, this one got it, all right, that type of thing. And that's just my best guess as to why they didn't go forward with it. But at the time that we were having this series of meetings, they had quite a bit on their plate, too. So,
any other nibbles out there for you then?
Oh, yeah. We have a machine on every continent except Australia and Antarctica, and we decided we can live without that Antarctica market after all. So, we're not Monsanto yet, but there are people who've been using it successfully commercially, yeah.
Can these electromagnetic bursts be recreated to the point where they can be beamed at people?
You mean the kind of bursts we were talking about from the natural places?
Yes.
I don't know. They can certainly be directed as far as like the ground goes. That's what a henge does. A henge is a C-shaped ditch that acts like a breakwater for ground current. This ground current travels almost entirely in the top meter or two of ground. All you have to do is dig a 6-foot deep ditch and you stop it dead. So if you dig a C-shaped ditch, all the ground current that wants to move through that area has got to come around and all go through the one piece of earth they leave undisturbed, which is the gap in the sea, so to speak. And so that concentrates all the current at that spot. That's the reason for, making a hinge, if you will.
What?
So in that sense, you can concentrate it and direct it.
All right, let's go west of the Rockies. You're up with us. Good morning.
Yeah, hi, it's Mike in Willow, Alaska here.
Hi, Mike.
Yeah, I know where you can find all the answers you said that have been lost over the millennia here, for centuries.
Yeah, well, obviously we've rediscovered some of them, but I'm sure there seems to be other parts we haven't, I'm sure.
All you have to do is look in the basement of the Vatican and the basement of the Smithsonian.
If you'll pick the locks for me, I'll take the flashlight, okay?
Well, anyway, that's where they are.
All right, thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay, next up, let's go east of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi.
I had to chuckle at that last call. This is Shirley in Texas, and I appreciate you taking my call. My compliments to you, Mr. Norrie, and Coast to Coast for the service that you render to us all.
Well, you're very kind.
Absolutely wonderful. Mr. Burke, in retrospect, having visited the petroglyphs outside of Albuquerque, I recall the wonderful feeling I had as I visited that, but had no idea that there was any connection to something that you're discussing this evening. But my question to you is, there are companies who are selling products, mattress covers, which are filled with magnets. And I wondered if you knew anything about those and if this is supposed to, of course, they're touted to be healthy.
Yeah, no, I really don't know anything about those. And I'll tell you, I had a girlfriend a few years back who was trying to urging me to use one on my bad knee. And I didn't, you know, being the scientific type, I didn't want to use anything. I couldn't understand how it worked. And I read every book I could find on the subject, and as far as I was concerned, nobody knows how it works. But after a while, my knee was getting so bad, I finally decided, hey, you know, what does it hurt to try? And I have to tell you, the result for me personally was the closest thing to a medical miracle I've ever experienced.
Really? It worked, huh? Happened.
Yeah, I had a knee that had been in pain for eight months, and it was going so bad. I was having trouble working, and I think I only ended up using this special knee magnet type elastic brace for a few hours, and I haven't had a problem with my knee since. And that was 10, 12 years ago.
Oh, remarkable. Thank you so much for your answers and for the whole program this evening.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
I always thought there was something to magnets.
Yeah, I don't know what it is, but it looks like at least some of the time it works. And actually, I have read a controlled scientific study that's been published in a peer-reviewed scientific journal that they have been proven effective for relief of pain from diabetic neuropathy in the feet.
I think what it does is it aligns your body with something.
It must. It may, you know, I don't know if it's the hemoglobin molecules in your blood, which are made out of iron or what, I really don't know. But for certain situations, for some people, it works. And maybe we should have known that, because I think the sports doctors were the ones to use them first. And it's my experience, those guys are usually the ones that are on the cutting edge.
Well, and I know they used to use lasers, for example, on injured horses way before they used them on people.
Yeah, okay, and they still do use them on horses very successfully, I know. Yeah.
Next up, let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hello there.
Hi.
Yes, sir.
This is Ron in Texas, and I wanted to ask, first of all, it's a great program. I'm really enjoying it.
Thanks.
And I wanted to ask about, Mr. Burke, are you familiar with the Dolmen archaeological rocks in Ireland?
In where?
In Ireland.
No, I don't think I am.
What do they do, sir?
Well, what they are is I pulled one up and I saw them some time ago. They're called Dolmen. And when you said
Dolmen, I'm sorry, I misunderstood you. Sure, I am. Sure, the rock towers, the stone towers.
Well, no, this one, the one I'm talking about is not a tower. It's like a great big stone three-legged milk stool, but it's elongated.
Yeah. Okay. And my belief is that in the old days it was covered with dirt. That's one version of them. Yeah.
I just wondered if they might not function in that same way, because I've just been curious about them ever since I saw them.
Oh, no, I believe they do. I believe those were one of the more primitive versions of these same, what I've been calling rock chambers, that were built from Ireland to India in the thousands, over a 6,000-year period. Because they use, I believe, some of them were originally, that was what we see now is the skeleton. It's as if we're seeing an ancient building where the brick has fallen off and all we see now are the girders. But I believe a lot of those, they had been built as a framework and then covered with rock and possibly smaller stones, because what's happened to a great number of these things everywhere, as you know, even in Egypt, is that later peoples often carried away the smaller stones for building material, and all you're left is the biggest parts. But yes, I do believe that those are, once upon a time, functioned the same way as these other stone chambers I'm talking about that did improve the seeds so dramatically when we tested them.
There are 100 dolmens scattered throughout Ireland. Most of them, they say, were used as tombs.
Yeah, because they'd find a dead body in one at least once in a while. And
it's probably somebody who stood there for energy too long and cooked himself.
Well, it's unfortunate that I think that archaeology is not more interdisciplinary, because there's a very clear-cut record that we present in some detail with the references in our book that right up until recent decades even, dead bodies were associated with increased fertility. And I'm talking to the point of where as late as in the 20th century, I think it was Finnish farmers, they would go dig up some bones from the cemetery and put them in the field while they plowed, and then they'd return them to the cemetery. And a lot of these dolmens in, not so much dolmens, I guess, maybe, but passage graves, which are sort of a little bit related to them, but on a bigger scale, in England, which have also been called graves, it's obvious that in some cases people came and borrowed these bones and then brought them back, because they try to put them back in the same spot, only not knowing their anatomy. In some cases, the femur would be upside down, and they'd have the head of a female on the body of a male, and that sort of thing. So I do believe there's been this long connection in both the New World and the Old World, and that includes the Mayan human sacrifices too.
That's the way to do it. Hey, John, we are out of time. I want to thank you. You're a home run, my friend. You take care of yourself.
Thank you, sir. Good night.
What a great program this was. For Kyrus Coburn, Steve Carr, Wayne Roberts, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Gino Salvati, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasaur, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.